The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Presidents, I would have thought, are most likely to do this when they're least accountable, when they're out of, on their way out of office. They've already lost the election, or it's the end of their second term, and the pardon power is supposed to be about accountability, and so it would be really bad because the people wouldn't have a chance to weigh in on it. In an odd sort of way, I think the fact that he has as part of his platform that he would pardon himself and a bunch of other people means that if he did win, having that on his platform, he would have a stronger argument to make about being able to pardon himself, about being immune while he's in office.
I'm Alan Rosenstein, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota and Senior Editor at Lawfare. And this is the Lawfare Podcast for June 20th, 2023. Last November, President Trump became Candidate Trump when he formally announced his campaign to retake the White House in 2024. And then earlier this month, the Department of Justice indicted Trump over his unauthorized possession of classified documents. In doing so, it gave him another title, Defendant Trump. How will all of these roles interact with each other at the level of law and just practical logistics? How will the obligations of Defendant Trump interfere with Candidate Trump's ability to conduct his presidential campaign? And if Candidate Trump becomes Convicted Felon Trump, and also then President Trump, what happens then? To think through these issues, I spoke with two members of the Lawfare Extended Universe. Stephanie Pell, Lawfare Senior Editor and a former federal prosecutor in the Southern District of Florida, and Brian Cult, a law professor at Michigan State and one of the foremost experts on presidential disqualification and removal. It's the Lawfare Podcast, June 20th. Stephanie Pell and Brian Cult on how the Trump indictment will affect the Trump campaign and the potential Trump presidency.
The first question I want to ask, and I'm going to ask Brian this, is a question that I've actually gotten a lot while talking to reporters over the past week or so about this indictment. And that is kind of a basic one. What legal implications, if any, does Trump's indictment have on his ability to run for president? I've gotten a lot of questions, especially from folks outside the country who are sort of less familiar with the U.S. system, just kind of assuming that someone under indictment cannot run for the highest office in the land. And Brian, since you've thought, I think, more about presidential disqualification than maybe anyone alive, just love to start by getting your perspective on this question.
Legally, there is really nothing standing in the way of someone under indictment from running for president. We have a few constitutional qualifications to run for president, and those have been interpreted as being exclusive. So politically, absolutely. But legally, there's nothing standing in his way. And there have been people who have run for president from prison before. So yeah, it seems odd, but that's how we do it here.
As to the specific charges at issue, that seems very straightforward. I am curious, though, and here obviously we're hypothesizing because this indictment has not come down yet. But if down the line there are further indictments, specifically around January 6th, specifically around insurrection, do those indictments have any potential disqualifying role? Because of course, something you know much more about than I do, the 14th Amendment does put limitations on the ability of politicians to hold office if they have committed insurrection against the United States. Does an indictment, do you think, would an indictment have any legal effect prior to any sort of conviction?
An indictment? No. 14th Amendment Section 3 does seem to preclude people who have engaged in insurrection from being president, but it's not self-executing, and it's not clear what it would take to make that happen. Would it have to be a conviction in court? Would it have to be a decision by Congress? That much isn't clear. But I think what is clear is even if a conviction were enough, it would require just that, a conviction, and an indictment by itself would not suffice.
So now that we have that sort of legal point out of the way, let me turn to you now, Stephanie. You are a very experienced federal prosecutor, and not just any federal prosecutor, but someone who did national security work in the Southern District of Florida, which gives you particular visibility into not just federal cases generally, but into how the Southern District operates. I'd like to ask you to sort of walk through the stages of a federal trial, from the arraignment that we saw earlier this week, what we should expect over the next several months, over the next 12 months, with an aim of thinking through how that might affect, almost as a logistical matter, not as a political matter per se, but just as kind of logistical and practical matter, Trump's ability to do the sort of campaigning that he would want to do. So let's start with what Trump, the defendant, can expect as claims on his time and attention over the next 6 to 12 months.
So as you note, the defendant Trump was arraigned. And as part of that arraignment, the magistrate judge issued something called the standing discovery order. That is a routine thing that happens, and it starts to set out various rules and deadlines, and specifically it maps in many ways to Federal Rule of Evidence 16, which requires the government to provide the defendant with various types of discovery. So that's all going to start now. In addition, I would say in the next week or coming weeks, certainly, the judge, District Judge Cannon, is going to issue an order for a pretrial conference and scheduling conference where various deadlines are going to be set. I think we are also going to see, which doesn't happen in every case, but the government sooner rather than later make a motion under the Classified Information Procedures Act for a pretrial SIPA conference. And as part of that, move for a protective order to protect this classified information. And that is going to start a rather lengthy process. Now, in terms of, how is this going to impact Trump's ability to campaign vis-a-vis his time? Certainly, one of the conditions that was set as part of his ability to be released pretrial on his own recognizance, one of the conditions was that he has to show up for court hearings. So, it is the judge's prerogative to set various deadlines. She, in this case, has to be cognizant of the Speedy Trial Act, which on its face says that after a defendant makes his initial appearance, the trial is to commence in 70 days. Of course, that's not going to happen. There are many things that you begin to exclude time from that 70 days because there's an entire motion practice that's going to happen, both on the government side and on the defense side. There has been a lot of public reporting that, we are likely to see in the near future, potentially motions to dismiss the indictment, motions with respect to prosecutorial misconduct, and other things where the defense is going to sort of try and strike at the heart of the case and just get the whole thing dismissed. I don't expect that to happen, but it starts to add time, or I should say take time away from that speedy trial clock. Probably in the most complicated national security case that I was part of the investigative and trial team on, by the time the last defendant was indicted, and his presence in the case brought in all kinds of complex classified information procedure issues, it took more than 2 years to get the case to trial. Now, I don't want to make too, you know, significant a comparison. These are very different kinds of cases. What I will say is that the complexity of the case is going to take time. And in many respects, that may play to defendant Trump and candidate Trump's favor.
So there's a lot in there, and I want to break it down into some component parts. So we have the arraignment, and I want to talk about sort of what the conditions were and what that says about, you know, the trial going forward. We have Judge Cannon, and that's a topic of endless discussion, but also relevant here for obvious reasons. And then we have this issue of SEPA and protective orders kind of more generally. So let's start with the arraignment. So I think one observation a lot of folks have made, and I think it's a correct one, is that the government's approach to defendant Trump has been extraordinarily lenient. One cannot imagine in any sort of comparable national security classified documents case that a defendant would be, you know, let off without any bail, personal recognizance, not to have any travel restrictions, to still be able to talk to people about the case. Let me ask you, why do you think DOJ did that? I mean, is it just that they want to sort of keep their powder dry because they recognize that they need to be very sensitive about being perceived or of actually interfering with candidate Trump activities, even as they're prosecuting defendant Trump? And, you know, how did you read DOJ's quite remarkably lenient, you know, so lenient that the magistrate judge actually wanted more restrictions than DOJ did, it seemed, at times.
So, Alan, you may recall that our colleagues Ben Wittes and Anna Bauer recorded a podcast earlier this week where they talked about the conditions of release, and they both agreed these were pretty light conditions. And I don't disagree with that. But I do think it is important to remember, you know, what the point is here and what standard governs what the court is trying to do. And a statute tells us that the court is looking to find the least restrictive condition or combination of conditions which will reasonably assure the appearance of the person and the safety of any other person and the community. Now, you know, the government could have tried to make stronger arguments that under the statute, the defendant was a risk of flight, or there's a second prong if they established that he was likely to obstruct justice or threaten a witness. Those would have been two prongs. I mean, frankly, those fall under the pretrial detention statute. The government did not seek pretrial detention, and I don't see that happening at this point. But yeah, the government used a light touch, and you know, I think the government realizes this is a rather unprecedented situation, and so as long as the conditions can be met, such that the defendant is going to show up to court and, you know, not obstruct proceedings, intimidate witnesses, then you're supposed to look to find the least restrictive conditions. And I don't think the government is going to be looking for ways to interfere with candidate Trump running. You know, everybody's situation is a little different, and this one is quite unique.
That's very fair. And I, you know, I suspect that some of these issues are not going to be a problem. You know, it's not going to be, we're not going to lose Donald Trump somewhere. He's not going to flee to Russia. I'm sure he'll make it to his court appearances. But
I mean, I know he's going to say, I don't have a reason to flee. I'm running for president, right?
Of course. But it does seem to me that this last part, right, not obstructing justice, not intimidating witnesses, that's going to be really hard. I mean, this gets a little bit into this conversation we're going to have a bit later about him saying things on the campaign. But, you know, what, right after he was arraigned, he had a press conference and he called Jack Smith a thug and you know, he talked about fighting. You know, this again, you know, he's obviously not on trial for January 6th, not yet, but obviously that's in the background. I mean, to be perfectly honest, I'm curious what you think. I'm not super optimistic that Trump is going to be able to keep his mouth shut or not obstruct or not intimidate witnesses. And I'm just curious, I mean, do you think there's going to be a point at which Jack Smith just gets really fed up and says, look, we really tried, but, you know, we can't have you out there as you know, if you're going to be like this because you're a criminal defendant. I mean, can you imagine this happening?
I guess I can imagine it, but I think a lot has to happen before we can ever get there. I think the first thing that the government might do if, you know, defendant Trump engages in conduct that, you know, he would argue is part and parcel of campaigning, but, you know, there could come a time where these interests collide. And so the first thing that I think the government would do would be to seek, you know, an order from Judge Cannon to try and prohibit. But, you know, we saw, I think, a little bit of this in the New York case where, at least from the press accounting that I read, the public reporting, the judge in the New York case did not issue any kind of gag order. What seemed to be concerned about, you know, the First Amendment issues and interests, you know, running into the things the government was concerned about.
So let's actually use this to talk about these you know, so-called gag orders. Let's abstract away from Trump for a second. Can you just, again, as a former prosecutor, just taking a run-of-the-mill, you know, case, maybe even a run-of-the-mill high-profile case, as a general matter, what as a matter of both law on the one hand and also practicalities on the other hand, what can or cannot defendants say publicly while they are standing for trial, right? You know, my understanding is that any lawyer worth their salt will turn to their defendant and say, you don't say anything, right? You do not open your mouth during this trial unless I tell you to, and otherwise I will speak to you. And can you just explain why that's so important? Why every single defense lawyer says that? And at what point is it not just a defense lawyer saying that, but the judge also saying, stop talking about this case?
So I have to say, normally when I'm used to thinking about these issues, it's, you know, the government has to be extremely careful that it doesn't say anything outside of an indictment or a pleading or in court, you know, in a hearing that would in any way prejudice the defendant's right to a fair trial. So that's really sort of my orientation to all of this. But to your point, the reason that defense counsel don't want their clients talking is that they will be saying, they say incriminating things that then can be used against them. Now, you make, and we, you know, we see that happening with defendant slash candidate Trump.
Are you saying that there's no presidential campaign privilege?
Maybe there is. I am not aware of one. But now, of course, defense counsel have at times, I don't remember in a case, I'm not recalling in a case that I was involved in, because we're going back many years, where a court had to gag any, so to speak, any defense counsel or, you know, more appropriately, order them not to speak about certain things in public. Because, of course, the defendant needs to have a fair trial. There needs to be a fair and impartial jury that you are able to choose. I mean, the government, you know, has to be able to try its case in a non-tainted jury pool, if you will. And so such statements made by defendant or defense counsel could also have the ability, you know, to taint the jury pool such that you couldn't be able to impanel a fair and impartial jury.
But would you expect that, as with conditions of release, that it would take an awful lot, and we'll have many podcast episodes between now and then if it comes to it, it'll take an awful lot before, you know, the judge in particular tries to limit what Donald Trump can say on the campaign trail about this. Now, that's a separate question than if Trump stupidly says something that's incriminating. No one can do anything about that. But on this sort of gag order issue, you don't expect that to happen, even though he might say some crazy stuff.
I don't expect it to happen anytime soon, and I think it would be need to be really egregious. I mean, that's just my gut reaction.
So last question for you, Stephanie, and then I do want to turn to Brian to talk about the sort of the potential President Trump issues that arise if he does win in 2024. Let's talk about Judge Cannon and what she can do legitimately or less legitimately to sort of separate candidate Trump from defendant Trump. And here I do want to say, you know, Judge Cannon, and again, I think most people at this point are very familiar with the mess she made during the special master Mar-a-Lago search incident. She's not coming into this with, from my perspective, a lot of credibility. But at the same time, I do want to give her a bit of the benefit of the doubt. And I also want to recognize that I think any judge in her position, right, would be trying very, very hard to separate the trial aspect of this from the presidential campaign aspect of this, right? I think you could find the most, you know, far left judge, and they would also be bending over backwards within the law to separate those two things, because I think everyone has agreed that we don't want to be using the criminal process to interfere in the political process more than is absolutely necessary. So given that, what are the sorts of things that Judge Cannon in particular can do, you know, whether it's SEPA specific or just generally, to minimize the impact of the trial on candidate Trump? And at what point would you start getting worried that this was going beyond what you would want any judge to do in this situation, and start worrying that she's maybe not playing it straight in the way that sort of a lot of us began to be quite concerned about during the special master fiasco?
As you rightly note, this is a challenging case for any judge. You know, one of her jobs is to keep the case moving consistent with all of the other issues that have to be raised and resolved, protecting the defendant's rights. I guess we're going to get into, you know, a question of, is the Trump defense going to ask for continuances for the purpose of allowing him to attend a campaign event? We're not there yet. I do think there is going to be, as I noted before, a number of complicated pretrial issues, some of them that relate to classified information, some of them that do not, that are just going to have this case take a long time. And, you know, she has the right to take these matters under consideration and give them the due time that they deserve for purposes of issuing her own order and dotting her I's and crossing her T's. You know, I would start to worry if, you know, she were doing things that were just outside the bounds of the law as we understood it, in either in the SEPA context or some other issues that defense might raise. As folks have been talking about on the Lawfare podcast and in other places all week with respect to Classified Information Procedures Act, I mean, if she does something again that is just so outside the bounds of the law and markedly unfair to the government, SEPA provides the opportunity for an interlocutory appeal. So it is possible that, you know, the government, time gets added on, because if the government has to start appealing these things to the 11th Circuit, while that may be done on an expedited basis, these things still take time. But there is certainly the opportunity to create delay just through the normal routine and processes that this case is going to have to go through. You know, I would start to get worried again, you know, if her rulings are just, again, so outside the bounds of the law.
Given all of this, given how complex this is, and that we're dealing with, you know, potentially a bit of a, I was going to say loose cannon. I did not intend that pun, though. I'm going to take credit for it. Now that I've said it, you know, I won't hold you to this, but what's your gut? Do you think we are going to get a trial before the primary season really, you know, heats up in, I don't know when Super Tuesday is or when this all starts, but I don't know, let's call it 10 months from now, let alone before the election? I guess I'm not super optimistic, but I think you have a better sense than I do.
I can't see this getting to trial before the election. I may be wrong. But maybe for let me give you a hypothetical where maybe could be wrong. You know, this indictment deals with a lot of highly classified information. If for the sake of argument, I don't think the government's going to do this, but if it just says, we really have no SEPA issues of note, you know, we're just going to declassify all of this stuff. So you cut out a huge chunk of litigation. I don't see that happening. We will know more in the coming weeks. But given the complexities of the case as they currently appear through reading the indictment, I would not be willing to bet money that this case would get to trial before the election.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. I want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan
when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
So let's fast forward, and this is a good opportunity to now pivot to Brian. Let's fast forward to the election. Donald Trump is elected president. God help us all. What happens at that point? Let's say, let's kind of split this into two branches. Let's say, as I suspect is probably more likely than not, that there will not have been a trial. At the very least, there will not have been a verdict and a conviction and a sentencing before the election, before the inauguration. We'll sort of maybe combine those two. What happens at that point? You know, can an investigation continue of a President Trump? Does that even matter if Trump can just tell his DOJ to knock it off? Just what happens just to the investigation? And then after that, we'll start talking about what happens with the potential conviction and prison sentence.
Well, during the period between the election and inauguration day, of course, there are transition issues, sort of a segue between being candidate Trump and President Trump would be President-elect Trump, who might need some leeway for the work of the transition that he needs to do, but I think less leeway than he would need as a candidate and less certainly than he would need as president. Once he is president, though, then we run into some constitutional arguments. He could argue, first of all, if the Department of Justice wants to continue with the case, he could argue that they can't. He could try as a practical matter to make sure that they don't by firing anyone who tries to move forward with it. But even if he doesn't fire them, and even if they purport to be able to go forward with it, despite past practice of not prosecuting sitting presidents, he can still go into court and make the constitutional argument that he is immune while in office. And that has never been litigated. It would, if that's how it's set up, it would get litigated that time. And we would have to see. The memo that DOJ had saying that they wouldn't got all the attention, but the constitutional argument is still there in the background. So that gives him an incentive to, if it looks like there might be a trial before he's president, that gives him an incentive to run out the clock. Because once he's president, he has not a slam dunk argument, but a pretty decent argument that would take a while to sort through, that they've got to hit pause at that point.
So walk us through that constitutional argument. Sort of, Trump famously said that he has an Article 2, and the Article 2 lets him do whatever he wants. Presumably, he'd have to get a little more sophisticated than that. So just schematically, what is the argument that he would make? And what exactly is he arguing? Is it that he is immune? That he is immune absolutely? That he is immune while in office? That has to be paused? That has to be dismissed? What do you think would be his sort of best argument here?
The standard argument is for temporary immunity. There's not really a good argument that once you become president, everything just gets dismissed automatically. The argument is based on, not on anything directly in the text, but rather on the constitutional structure of the presidency. And it sort of goes along with the unitary executive theory that the president alone sits atop the executive branch, and the other branches, or the Federalist version of the argument, a state prosecutor, doesn't have the power to disrupt that, to prosecute, to haul into court, to possibly imprison. The executive branch of the federal government is constitutionally problematic. And so the argument goes, things have to wait until he's out of office. And of course, the statute of limitations might become an issue at that point. You could say that if you're hitting the pause button, you should hit pause on that, but it's not clear because, again, the Constitution doesn't really specify. And we've managed to avoid push coming to shove on this issue during the Nixon investigation, during the Clinton investigation. But I think given all of the potential criminal liability he's facing in the run-up to the election, if he wins, I think we would finally get an answer to these questions.
And just to clarify, because you did mention the state prosecutor point, which I think is an important one, the argument there is not that the president is the head of the state executive branch. It's presumably that the supremacy clause just generally prohibits the states from taking any action that would undermine the federal separation of powers. I understand the within federal law the unitary executive argument that, look, DOJ works for him, so he can just tell them to knock it off. It's a little less unclear what the argument is against a state prosecution, except a kind of free-floating concern with state interference in the basic functioning of the executive branch.
Right. It's a federalism, a division of powers argument. It sort of reduces down to the legal process question. If there is a president who needs to be prosecuted, who decides that instead of being president, because the argument would go, you can't really function as president at the same time that you're in prison or even on trial, who gets to decide that? And the immunity argument goes that Congress decides that he's temporarily immune while he's in office. And you can prosecute him once he's out of office, and only Congress can hasten that day of when he's out of office. And looking at it from the perspective of the state, it would be extra problematic if one district attorney in one state was able to sort of arrest the executive branch of the federal government. It's almost a McCulloch versus Maryland sort of sentiment that the part can't control the whole like that. And it's, I think, helpful to step back from the particulars of the Trump case and think more generally. Pick a president that you like, historical or future. Pick a president that you like. None of them were unanimously beloved. Imagine one prosecutor in one part of the country that doesn't like this president, purporting to have the power to haul him to court wherever in the country and really prevent him from being able to do his job. That's the argument. That's inconsistent with the supremacy clause, as you mentioned, with the division of powers for one local prosecutor to have that power.
So this raises, I think, a question worth talking about, which is, you know, whether it is in fact true that the Constitution is sort of silent on these issues, and therefore we have to engage in some sort of creative constitutional reasoning. Because, you know, and again, I'm nervous bringing this up because I'm talking to sort of the expert on the 25th Amendment. But you know, if you read the 25th Amendment and then you read the part of Article 2 that talks about the vice presidency, I mean, it does talk about things like, well, look, the president is sometimes unable, right? The inability, I think, is the word used in the Constitution, to discharge his duties. So it's actually contemplated, right, that whether at the federal level or perhaps at the state level, the president is charged, investigated, convicted. He is therefore unable to carry out his duties. No problem. He has a vice president to do that. What do you make of that argument, which, you know, at the very least has some textual basis for it?
Yeah, so the 25th Amendment argument is an interesting one, and I do address this a little bit in my last book on Section 4. But just to break that down, if the president himself says, you know what, I'm not going to be able to do my job and defend myself at the same time, I'm going to declare myself under Section 3 of the 25th Amendment, I'm going to declare myself unable and hand over power temporarily to the vice president until all of this is done, and then take it back when I'm ready. Yeah, I mean, that would work. If he is adamant that he's not giving up one iota of power, then Section 4 might come in, where the vice president, the cabinet, and if the president fights them, two-thirds of the House, two-thirds of the Senate can say, no, you've got to hand over power while this is going on. But there are two limits with the 25th Amendment argument. I think it's great that the 25th Amendment is there to provide a mechanism for transferring power, but that still leaves the question of who decides. Does a prosecutor, a state prosecutor somewhere, does the Department of Justice, against the president's expressed wishes, have the power to force that issue, to render him unable? Is that legitimate? And the second point is a more practical one, and that is, if the president doesn't want to hand over power under the 25th Amendment, let's say a court rules that he's not immune and the prosecution goes forward and he says that he's able to do his job, and the cabinet and the vice president disagree and he contests that, and so it goes to Congress. Unless there's that two-thirds in the House and two-thirds in the Senate saying that he needs to hand over power, he keeps power. The deck is stacked in Section 4 heavily in his favor, to the point where it's harder to displace him from power under the 25th Amendment than it would be to just impeach and remove him. And so I find it difficult to envision a situation in which you don't have a majority of the House and two-thirds of the Senate willing to impeach him, but you do have two-thirds in the House and two-thirds in the Senate saying we need to forcibly strip him from power. Strip power from him, I should say. So the bar is just so high with 25th Amendment Section 4. Now, of course, if he were the sort to say, oh, well, I better hand over power while I'm being prosecuted, then he probably wouldn't be in this situation in the first place. So there's that too.
One more avenue, it seems to me, that could provide a President Trump with relief from being Defendant Trump is, of course, the pardon power, which would not apply to any state charges, but would apply to federal charges. And it does seem to me that, you know, certainly if he has been convicted prior to becoming president, or even if there's just an investigation ongoing, even if it's withdrawn by his Justice Department, you know, Trump thinking ahead to a future administration would, I think, almost certainly try to self-pardon. And I'm curious what you think the legality of that is, both sort of on the substantive level, but also on the interesting procedural question of whether or not this is even the sort of thing that a court would want to deal with. You know, given that the pardon power is generally considered, you know, pretty broad and pretty plenary, and doesn't on its face have any exclusion for a self-pardon, though of course there are good reasons also to interpret it in a more limited way.
Yeah, I think I've been writing about this since my second year criminal procedure class back in the 1900s. But I think that, well, my standard answer when people say, can the president pardon himself, is, well, he can try. And if he does, then we'll find out, because there are good arguments on both sides. I can tell you, if I were a judge and the case came before me, how I would rule. But I long ago learned not to try and predict what the Supreme Court will do. And I'm glad that I thought about it, wrote about it in the abstract sense, because I think it's important for people to think about this, not in terms of the current case, but in terms of the general principle. Either presidents can pardon themselves or they can't. It's not a different answer if you support the president versus you don't, or what party. So the basic argument that he can pardon himself, which he has endorsed, is it doesn't say he can't. And it is a broad power. It is among the least limited presidential powers. It's not, doesn't require Congress to approve or empower him. It's largely exempt from judicial review. Of course, this wouldn't be, because it's not clear that his power includes this. The argument against it that I took out of that crim pro class 20 odd years ago is more complicated, but I think ultimately more compelling. And it has three parts. There's a textual part, there's a structural prudential part, and there's a historical part. The textual part, I think, is in some ways the strongest, because it directly confronts this notion that it doesn't say he can't. The Constitution says he can't pardon state offenses. He can't undo or preempt an impeachment. Other than that, it doesn't have any limits. So how could you say that there's this implied limit in there? But there is another limit in the text, and that is pardons have to be pardons. And what I mean by that is that if something is inherently inconsistent with what it means to be a pardon, even though the Constitution doesn't say that, we limit it. So just as an example that everyone agrees on, because the courts have said this, a pardon has to be of something already done. You can't pardon future acts. The Constitution doesn't say that. You know, the president can't say, I'm pardoning you for whatever you might do in the future. Doesn't say I can't. Well, it does say he can't, because that wouldn't be a pardon. And so the textual argument is that granting a pardon, which is what the Constitution gives him the power to do, is inherently bilateral. You can't grant something to yourself. You can't pardon yourself. It just doesn't make sense. I go back to the Latin root of the verb to pardon. It's the same Latin root as the verb to condone, the same root as the verb to donate. You can't make a donation to yourself. If it says you can make these kind of donations, you say, okay, well, I'll give one to myself. No, it doesn't make sense. That wouldn't be a donation. You can call it a donation, but it's not. You can't condone your own actions. It just doesn't make sense. It's not part of what the word means. The historical argument is based on what the framers said about it, which is nothing. When they were writing the pardon clause, they talked about presidents benefiting themselves by pardoning their cronies, their co-conspirators, even in a treasonous conspiracy. And they debated, well, does that mean we should eliminate the pardon power for treason? Because the president might be pardoning co-conspirators in his own treasonous enterprise. They specifically addressed that. And the answer that they came to, James Wilson, later Supreme Court Justice, said, if the president does something like that, he can be impeached and prosecuted. And so I look at that and say, well, clearly they didn't think he could pardon himself, or that would have been cold comfort. Oh, yeah, if he's leading this band of traitors and he pardons everyone, we'll just prosecute him once he's been impeached. If they thought that he could pardon himself, why wouldn't he pardon himself in that situation? So either they didn't think he could do it, or it just didn't occur to them at all that it was possible. But it's certainly, you can't look at that silence and say, oh, yeah, based on this discussion, they thought that he could, and they were so okay with it that it didn't even merit discussion. I just can't fathom that, looking at the notes. And then finally, I think most people would lead with this argument because I think it has the most intuitive appeal. There is the notion that no one can be the judge in their own case. You know, pardoners aren't judges as such, but thinking of this as part of the criminal justice process, in order for you to have criminal consequences, the prosecutor, the grand jury, the trial judge, the trial jury, and the president all have to agree. The president can pardon anyone. The judge can throw the case out. The jury can acquit. In all of the other steps in the process, we say you can't be the prosecutor in your own case. You can't be on the jury in your own case. You can't be the judge in your own case. And so I would say by that principle, you can't be the pardoner in your own case. You have to rely on someone else, either your successor or your vice president, if you want to hand over power temporarily, but not yourself. And that, you know, like everything else, there's an argument on the other side. You can say the Supreme Court has cited this maxim that you can't be the judge in your own case in all sorts of contexts where they've ruled that someone can't do something self-dealing. And that's true, but they've also not cited it in all sorts of cases where they've allowed self-dealing. And there are places where the Constitution seemingly frowns upon self-dealing in an implicit way, and there are other places where it allows it, like the vice president presiding over the electoral count under the 12th Amendment. All right, Al Gore in 2001 presiding over the disputed 2000 election. People are objecting, and it, you might say, well, he shouldn't be up there. He's the candidate. But he did. The 12th Amendment allows that. So, you know, it's typical constitutional law. There's flaws in every argument, and you just have to pick the one that's the least flawed.
So as we've been having this discussion, and I've been trying to sort of think about what my top line conclusion is. And my preliminary top line conclusion from listening to both of you and your very helpful analysis is that for the reasons Stephanie points out, it's very unlikely that we're going to get a trial, certainly not a conviction or a result, as it were, before the election. And that for the reasons that Brian has outlined, if Trump in fact wins, he either is going to just get off completely, or at the very least, this will be paused. This will not interfere with his presidency. And therefore, the conclusion that I draw is that it ultimately, and perhaps rightfully so in a democracy, hinges on the will of the voters. And that at the end of the day, you know, if we want Trump to be held accountable, whether for the documents, whether for the Georgia interference, whether for January 6th, it will rely on the voters first holding him politically accountable, either in the Republican primary or in the 2024 presidential election. I'd like to ask both of you, you know, if you agree with that, and also, you know, if you think that among all the terrible options, right, as usual, Trump has put the country in a world of bad options, you know, this option of ultimately this becoming yet another political issue may be okay, or maybe the least bad from a sort of small D Democratic perspective. So I'd like to start with Brian and then move on to Stephanie.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that underlying all of these arguments about pardons and about potential immunity while in office is this democratic notion. The reason that the president can't be sidelined because one prosecutor says so is precisely because the president is this national figure, the only one besides the vice president elected by the entire country. And the pardon power is given to the president because presidents are politically accountable to the whole country in a way that no one else is. So, you know, I complain about in my book, where I talk about self-pardons, or when you look at Nixon contemplating it on his way out of office, presidents, I would have thought, are most likely to do this when they're least accountable, when they're out of on their way out of office. They've already lost the election, or it's the end of their second term. And the pardon power is supposed to be about accountability. And so it would be really bad because the people wouldn't have a chance to weigh in on it. In an odd sort of way, I think the fact that he has as part of his platform that he would pardon himself and a bunch of other people means that if he did win, having that on his platform, he would have a stronger argument to make about being able to pardon himself, about being immune while he's in office. That would strengthen his claim. I don't think it would strengthen it enough that I would change my long-held views on these questions. But I think you're right. I think the nature of the constitutional issues here and the nature of the question of who decides keeps leading us back to this democratic principle that the people get their choice. The people get to decide who the president is.
Stephanie, what do you got?
So that's a very difficult answer to follow. Very, very eloquently expressed. I guess the only thing that I would add is that certainly the people not nominating or electing Trump is a much cleaner, less messy resolution to all of this. And, you know, as we saw in the Mueller investigation, there are limits to what the Justice Department or even Congress can do. So I guess I'm coming back to Brian's eloquent answer. This is really up to the people of the United States. And we shouldn't give over our power so easily. And assume that Jack Smith or some other prosecutor is going to save the day for us.
Well, I think we'll leave it at there for now, but this will continue, I'm sure, to be taking up residence in our minds for a long time to come. Thank you very much, Brian and Stephanie.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thanks.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare Material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th. Check out our written work at lawfareblog.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Noam Osmond of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stephens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.